The motivation for it is this problem of the missing satellites. And so what it boils down to is you run a big N-body simulation and using cold dark matter, and what you see is you see lots of these little dots all over the place. And all these little dots are subhalos. And then you go and you look in around our Milky Way, and while it's true that the Dark Energy Survey found a few more not too long ago, there aren't nearly as many dots here, which are to say there aren't nearly as many observed Milky Way satellites as there are what you would naively expect from an N-body simulation. So that's the missing satellite problem, and it's been around for a long time. And people argue about exactly how important, is this actually a problem, or is this just saying that, well, this is a dark matter simulation, maybe there are all these dots are there, and they just don't have stars in them, and so when you go looking for them, you won't see them. And that's a totally reasonable thing, right? It could just be something to do with astrophysics that we don't understand, that for some reason these little dots just don't form things that we can see. And so maybe there's a swarm of dark matter subhalos that are happily orbiting our Milky Way, and we just can't see them because they don't have stars or gas. So people now argue about whether how plausible that is, because some people say that, well, some of these satellites should be so large that we should be able to see them. That if you look at the properties of the ones that we see, it doesn't seem very plausible that all of these things have somehow been quenched. And that's the too big to fail problem. And so lots of arguments are going on about whether it's normal that we don't see all these things or not.
How about the possibility that simulations are not in the right places?
The theory can't be wrong. So it could be that there's something weird going on with dark matter. So one idea is that it could be warm dark matter. So
even beyond that, even if you have all the pieces correct, but the numerics is not correct. These are very challenging simulations.
They are very challenging simulations, but they're at least these are not things that are just barely resolved. That, and if you look at the high-resolution Aquarius simulations and things like that, the particle masses there are something like 10 to the 4 solar masses or something. And so these things would have thousands of particles in them. And so when you crank down the particle mass, what you keep finding is that these things... So if you were to run this simulation at higher resolution, you would see all of these dots there, and all that's going to happen is they're just going to get sharper. So So the simulations are at least converged in that you keep getting the same answer when you add more particles, but whether that's right or not is a different question. However, there's no obvious reason why these things would be a numerical artifact.
Then it moves into physics.
Yeah. And so it could be something to do with the dark matter. So if the dark matter has some non-thermal streaming velocity, then it just can't clump up into these small satellites. That's one option. To get what? So you could say, how many things should form at high redshift? And then all those things will eventually get accreted. However, they could get ripped apart when they get accreted. So if somehow the first generation of things formed and they were really puffy, then they would merge together, and then the resulting thing would be puffy, and then that would fall in, and then that would get stripped. So it's true that there's always going to be this memory of the initial condition, and so it is true that if something happened very early on, then that could bootstrap its way all the way through. But again, that's physics. So if that is what's going on, that's an interesting thing to know, right?
Didn't mention what you have in your study. That it's not just the resolution; it's just the gas physics is complicated and it's subgrid. You don't resolve individual stars, so that's the in some sense that's the most conservative solution.
It's the most the most conservative solution is to say the only thing we have any chance of understanding is gravity, mm-hmm. and that there's some complicated astrophysics that's going on that means that we can't really reliably identify subhalos. But then you're left with this sort of uncomfortable situation where your hypothesis is that there is this swarm of things going around that we have no way of detecting.
Until you come in. Right?
Until.
I don't agree with that. I don't think it's conservative to assume that we understand dark matter.
Yeah.
I don't think it's conservative to assume that putting cold dark matter in, assuming that we understand the physics of dark matter, I don't think that's conservative.
What is wasn't there like an hour or less?
That's right. Alternative things like
warm
dark matter are completely reasonable. I
don't want to argue. I'm the definition of conservative, so I mean, different people might feel conservative doing different things.
Well, it's conservative in the sense that otherwise there are no problems at all. Cold dark matter explains everything. We have this reliable, you know, it otherwise explains everything in a fairly straightforward way with no extra physics added. And it's just cold. So it's saying that we don't know what the actual thermal velocity of the particles is, but we think it's small. Whereas you go to something like warm dark matter, and suddenly there's a new scale in the problem, which is the velocities of the dark matter particles. And so you've introduced another knob. So before, with CDM, you just crank some knob all the way down to, you know, to very low, and now you have to set it to something in particular to get things to work.
But you have these tensions that you mentioned here, and you've got a few rotation curves, and all the things.
Yeah. Yeah, and they're all things that are happening on small scales. So there seems to be something going on with cold dark matter not really doing a great job of explaining what's going on small scales. So one,
I think if we're turning knobs in astrophysics, we should also turn knobs on dark matter, because we can understand much more about the particle physics model of that.
Yeah, but the nice thing about turning knobs on astrophysics is that those are knobs that we can actually see what happens when you turn them. And you could hope that we'll learn something more about it someday, whereas if you're just turning the knobs on the dark matter, it's kind of like...
turning those knobs might correspond to changing the interactions with the dark matter.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like
yeah. No, so I think the thing to do is to say, well, it might be just gas physics. It might be dark matter physics, but, you know, if there really are these clouds of dark matter going around, we should go looking for them. That is clearly the way science is supposed to work. You think these things are there, go find them. And if you think they're there, don't just assume they're there. And, you know, do what you can. So that's the idea. And so the way we're going at it is using strong gravitational lensing. So here's a version of gravitational lensing. So you have the observer down here, you have your dark matter halo here, you have your background source, you get the multiple paths coming in. And so this is, in general, sort of the standard cartoon, except that what's been added here is something that is going to be very important going forward in this field, which is that when you have some fairly complicated source, and so here the different colors would represent, say, things that are moving at different velocities that you could identify spectroscopically as being in particular at one spot if you have emission lines. Then they get sheared out in interesting ways, that you have some fairly regular thing here, and each one of these colors is basically acting as its own gravitational lens. Well, not lens, gravitational source. So each source here is, so these are basically three sources right next to each other, all getting sheared out by the same potential. And so you can already sort of see how this might be a useful way to be going after finding these little lumps, because these little lumps will tend to be closer to one color than they are to another. And so if you have sufficiently high resolution and careful measurements, you could actually see some distortions in these patterns coming from having little lumps of dark matter right next to it. So that's...
What are the colors?
So I think that's red. And no. So it's just saying that you have some source. Imagine you have like a spiral, a disk galaxy that's rotating. So what are you going to see is that one side's going to be moving towards you, one side will be away from you. So this would be, say, a red shift and a blue shift of some complicated system. So if you're looking using emission lines, then the emission lines will get moved left or right depending on the velocity. And so you could call that a color. And so the thing about, so this is supposed to be ALMA. And what's nice about ALMA is that as an interferometer, it works by doing, combining waves millimeter waves, and then looking at phase shifts that come from things being at different spots in the sky. But because you're working with waves and you're doing interferometry, you need to use very narrow channels, which means so ALMA naturally takes data at very high spectral resolution. So whenever ALMA takes a picture of the sky, the native data product has high resolution in the spectrum. So it's really an integral field unit in that you're getting the spectrum at every spot in the sky that it's in that field of view. And so you can use that as a way to do this lensing experiment.
So what a spectral line are you thinking about?
So for this, we're using, so we can use carbon monoxide, so the rotational levels of carbon monoxide, so CO lines, and also once ionized carbon, C+, is also extremely efficient. So to see exactly how this would work, so here is basically a simulated image configuration. So it's almost an Einstein ring, but not quite. And so I'm going to tell you that there's a substructure somewhere in this thing. So I've taken this mass, and it's just basically, well, so Yasher did this. It's basically just some smooth halo that looks kind of like a galaxy, and then a subhalo has been put down. And I claim that you can tell me where that thing is. So this is a pretty big subhalo. This was more like almost 10 to the 9. So that one's pretty easy. But I suspect that most of you, if you watch this a few times, will tell me that you think there's something funny going on up there. And what's happening is it's up there somewhere because it's pushing this thing over. So what lensing does is it comes up underneath and it pushes things out. So in general, whenever you have some mass, bending of light draws things in, but as you see it, it pushes things out. So you come up with a mass somewhere and it pushes things out. And so that's what's going on here, is that thing's getting pushed out. And so this is not a totally new idea. So this is, Neil Dalal did this 13 years ago using quasars in the radio. And so there, it's the same sort of idea. You look for multiply imaged radio sources, and you look for things that don't seem to be in quite the right spot. So the equivalent of this thing having been moved over a little bit. So if you were to try to fit a smooth model, you would never be able to get this thing having been shifted over with any smooth model. Then it requires something that's fairly localized up there. He was doing flux anomalies, but a flux anomaly is... So there's astrometric perturbations and there are flux anomalies and they're related. So if you move the image a little bit, you're moving it into a spot where it has either higher or lower magnification. And so the flux anomaly and the astrometric perturbations are just different versions of the same thing. So they did it for a small number of radio strong lenses that they could use, and the problem was they just ran out of lenses to use. That in the radio, people did these huge surveys a long time ago, and people followed them up, and they looked at all the possible strong gravitational lenses, and they basically found them all. And you could say, oh, well, why don't we just do another radio survey? But the problem with just doing another radio survey is that quasars are extremely bright. And as you go fainter and fainter, what you start picking up are more and more just normal star-forming galaxies. So instead of seeing multiply imaged quasars, what you'll start to pick up are star-forming galaxies at redshift 0.2 and 0.3. And no one cares about those. So you just get swamped by this foreground of radio sources that are very difficult to sift through
because
to find the lenses.
Much bigger, so you don't dissolve the substructure.
Yeah, and they're not lens because they're relatively nearby. So what happens is what they did initially is you did a big radio survey, you sifted through them very carefully, found a small number of lenses, did everything you could with those, and then they were done. And because then the next generation survey would find even more stuff that's not lenses, and it just became a problem of finding them. It's also been done in the optical. So Simona Vegetti in the optical, and this is in the infrared, optical and infrared. Both of these, and there it's the same idea. You just look for things that don't quite look right in the lensing geometry, and you can use that to try to identify substructures. And so they found one, and they found one, but in general, it's been slow going. So this is sort of an emerging field. Now what we're doing this with are with millimeter wave selected galaxies. So it turns out that if you do selection at millimeter wavelengths, you can turn out, you can be extremely efficient at discovering strong lensing. And it was something that I think we didn't really expect to be so good at when we started. So we're now approaching 100 of these systems of strong lenses. So we followed up dozens of them with ALMA, and almost all of them, when we follow them up with ALMA, what we see is we see stuff like this. So this is the ALMA emission on top of a HST image. So the ALMA's in red, the HST is there, and you see these rings. And so we found a whole bunch of these, and now we're using these to go looking for substructure. There it is. So what's magic about the millimeter is that if you look in the millimeter at the number density of sources as a function of brightness, it has this unbelievably sharp cutoff. And it's a sharper cutoff even than you generally see in any other population. And the reason for this cutoff is it's basically like the opposite of if you look out through our galaxy, as you go fainter and fainter in flux, you run out of stars because you hit the edge of the galaxy. Well, here you run out of super bright objects because what these things are, they're star-forming galaxies, and star formation peaked earlier on. And so what's happened is we just ran out of these active star-forming galaxies just below a redshift of 2. So if you look at all the models that people do for where all the star-forming galaxies are, they tend to basically peak at redshift 2 and beyond. And then since then, there are hardly any of these galaxies that are undergoing massive star formation. And what that means is that you lose that bright end of things that are relatively nearby. So because none of them are relatively nearby, they're all at high redshift, you end up with basically this cutoff right here, which just corresponds to star formation having stopped around redshift 2. And so you have this very sharp cutoff. And then what happens is you then say there's some fraction of these, and you can calculate just back of the envelope exactly what fraction it should be. So it should be something like 10 to the minus 4. If you say what fraction of the sky is strongly lensed, it works out to be something on the order of 10 to the minus 4. Above some magnitude, above some magnification. So you take 10 to the minus 4 of these, and you bump them up by a factor of, a few or up to 10 in flux. And you take 10 to the minus 4 of these, and you move them out. So you knock this thing down by 10 to the minus 4. You move them out, and you develop this tail that's out here. And so what's happened is, so while it's true that not very many of them have been magnified, there's just no background out here at all. So it becomes an incredibly easy way to find these strong lenses. You just look for really bright millimeter wave galaxies. And if they're not nearby, IRAS galaxy, if it's not M31 or something with an NGC number, it will almost always turn out to be a high redshift, strongly lensed galaxy. So it's... okay, so I can tell you that around here, we're looking at of order 1 per square degree. So this is maybe not even 1 per square degree. So it could be that this is something like per square arc minute. Not per square arc minute. But it's not per steradian. So what it almost certainly is dn ds, or dn d log s, and it must be steradian. And so the question of whether it's dn d log s or dn ds, we'll know exactly how to convert it into approximate numbers, but the units are going to be roughly per steradian. And so we're talking about roughly how many of these, but in our whole survey, we found about 100. So whatever the units are to this plot, and so I could dig them up because I can find exactly what this plot is. There probably is a version somewhere else in these slides that actually has units on them. But we have found roughly 100 of them in 2,500 square degrees. Yeah.
What was that
survey from? Oh, so that's 125th. So this was from SPT. So we found them from SPT. So this is using the South Pole Telescope, which is a CMB experiment at the South Pole. And here's what a chunk of our data looks like. So this, so it's actually, we're doing a CMB experiment, and this is all CMB fluctuations right here. So what you see right here are CMB fluctuations. This thing right here is a massive galaxy cluster, and that's the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect. And all of these dots are galaxies of some type. And in general, most of these will turn out to be radio sources. So I think 75 to 80% will be radio sources. And a few of them, so most likely either this one or this one, would be a dusty source. And it would be one of these strongly lensed things. So in a chunk of 4 square degrees, it's we have a pretty good chance that we would see one of these. So what we do is we get the spectrum, first of all, because we have multiple frequencies. So we can, first of all, figure out which ones are dusty. So it's a very simple algorithm. We take these things. We look at the between 90, 150, 220 gigahertz, we find out whether the spectrum is rising or falling. If it's rising, then we say it's dusty. If it's falling, we say it's a radio source. Let's say this one right here, if that one had a dusty spectrum, you then go look up in the NGC catalog. You say, is there some very nearby object that happens to be right there? And if it's not some well-known nearby object, then we say this is probably a strong lens. And that's the entire selection that's done. Just first of all, is the spectrum going up or down? And is it a famous galaxy? If not famous, then lensed.
So you're doing like science of the stuff that we normally mask out in the CMB.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And
and is it kind of like the opposite of the way we identify SC clusters? So SC, you know, you look for the particular drop and you're just doing like a similar thing. You've got a few bands.
Yeah.
You know what shape it should be doing. And you say, oh, it's this shape, it's SC. And like, okay, it's this shape.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, the way that this project evolved is that the SPT first generation of experiments, there were all these grad students working on it, but there were two in particular that had done the bulk of the work as grad students. And they were the first ones to be up to graduate. And so they divided it up and they said, okay, one gets the dark spots and one gets the bright spots. And so the dark spots were the galaxy clusters, and that was Zach Stanishevsky. And so he said, look, we found some galaxy clusters using the Sinyaev-Zeldovich effect. That's cool. And the bright spots went to Joaquin Vieira, and he said, wow, these things are all lensed. All the dusty ones are lensed. That's pretty weird. So it was kind of a nice distribution. And then after that, people finally got around to measuring all these spots. But that was the second generation was actually doing the CMB experiment part of it. Okay, so we now have the sample, and so we had this theory that they were all lensed, and this is what, so there had been hints from these other people that that was what was going on, and then Yasher did the calculations more carefully just to figure out exactly what was going on out there. So there are the predicted unlensed counts, and then you basically fold them through some lensing machinery, and you say, what should the lensed counts be? And then you find that there's some degeneracies into exactly what the sources are, what the lenses are. So it's kind of a messy calculation. But when you do it, what you find is that indeed, so here are our source counts. Indeed, they're all lensed. And so now you can see it's per square degree. So here's the number above some threshold per square degree. So we're looking at, so that's 0.1. So we're looking at 0.2 or something per square degree. Is how many there can be. But the details of the lensing are quite messy. So it depends a lot on exactly how big the sources are, because if it's a really big source, then only part of it gets lensed and it gets kind of washed out. So the calculations are a little messy, but in the end, our purpose in doing these calculations was to say, are these things all lensed? So at the time, we didn't know. So we had this plausibility argument that, well, we know that the unlensed counts are supposed to fall off precipitously if you look in the millimeter, submillimeter, like scuba. And so they're not just the scuba sources, they're something new. And so that's how we managed to convince ourselves that they were lensed, but we still didn't really know. And we didn't really believe they were lensed until we looked at them with ALMA. And then when we looked at them with ALMA, indeed we saw they all have this sort of funny morphology where they seem to straddle the center of some optical galaxy. So, you know, there's ones like that that are, and then there's some that are tough to convince yourself that they're lensed. Some are easy. And so, you know, we get the ALMA follow-up to figure out what's going on. And then you just drill down further to figure out what's going on. So at the same time, Herschel was finding these things. So SPT, we have something around 100 of these things. Herschel's got a whole sample of them as well. And it's the same idea. You just get really bright things, and you're off to go.
Does Herschel cover a similar area?
So Herschel's a much smaller area. So the way Herschel had to do it was a little bit more difficult in that they... So, you know, you have this number that's 0.1 per square degree, and they're doing surveys that are of order 100 square degrees or a few hundred square degrees. I don't know exactly what ALMA is. But in order to get interesting numbers, the only what they have to do is they have to dig further into here.
Okay.
And as you start digging, so, you know, with SPT, we just clipped off the bright ones. We said, you know what, let's just stick with the bright ones because those are easy. What you could do is you could push down to lower fluxes. As you push down to lower fluxes, what's going to happen is you're going to start having to sift through unlensed ones. So once you're working down here, it's going to be a mix of some lensed, some unlensed, and you just, it's harder work. However, if you've got the manpower to do it, then why not? So with SPT, that this was getting close to our flux threshold at the time, so that's where we were kind of stuck. So with the next generation of, with our current data, we could do it all again and dig down to lower flux levels by a factor of 5 or something like that. But if we know that if we do that, it's going to be a mix of lensed and unlensed, and then we're going to have to do more work. And we've already got... Well, so the problem is this number of 0.2 per square degree means that... So the field of view of ALMA is something like 30 arc seconds, which means that, you know, you'd have to be down here before you'd expect to get reasonable counts, maybe even further. So you'd have to be down here. You'd need a source density up there before you would expect to see a few of them in ALMA. And once you get up there, hardly any of them are going to be lensed because this luminosity function is deep enough, is flattened out to the point where you're going to be swamped by the stuff that's already there. So there will still be lens things there. It's just it's not going to be as many. So we had to do something with this ALMA data. So the thing about ALMA is it's an interferometer. And what's interesting about interferometers is that they make funny maps. Like the goal of an interferometer is to get high resolution. But what astronomers want to do is get really nice maps. But if you make maps with an interferometer, you have to be careful. So if you start with an image that looks kind of like this, and you feed it through a toy interferometer. So if you had a single baseline, so you just had two telescopes, that one object would look like this. So that's not a very good interferometer. And then you just keep adding more baselines. And so that's just combining more and more pairs. And eventually what you see is that you're sharpening up this image and getting it back. And then you add some sky rotation, and that fills it in a little more. But you still see all this modeling here. This background is not noise. There's been no noise added to this. This is just the ringing from the different combinations of things that you've added in. And so, so this is just the dirt. This is just the dirty beam, right here. So this is what I'm showing here. Is this is the dirty map, in the language. So what we do is instead of actually fitting the map, we just fit directly to the visibility data, which is always the right thing to do. And so what I'm trying to motivate is why that is the right thing to do. And it's because if you fit to the image, you're going to have all of this stuff here, which you have to keep track of, and you have to do something clever. So you either have to somehow do some deconvolution, and when you do a deconvolution, effectively what you're going to end up doing is guessing what the missing values are in here, and not just setting them to zero. Because effectively what's happened here is you've said, I know what the values are at all these points right here, but in between, I'm just going to set it to zero because I don't have any data. And then I'm going to make a map out of that. And so if you want to compare that with a model, you better do some work. So instead, what we do is we just work individually with what every one of these pairs of telescopes has measured, and you just do a big fit. Sure, but those are nonlinear, Yeah, I mean, you could, if you're very careful, you should be able to do stuff in either plane. It's just, in order to do it in the image plane, you're going to have horrible correlations between your pixels. And so it's messy. Whereas if you do it in this space over here, everything is barely correlated. And so Yasher spent a lot of time developing a pipeline to do this. And what was amazing is that there was this object right here. So this was the ALMA image that we got. So this was cycle zero ALMA data, and it was the first half. So we had cycle zero, we had half low resolution, half high resolution. And this was the data, and this was the model he came up with. And the model that fit looked like this, that there was a dot, there was a blob that was right here, and there was the caustic it was sitting on, so strong lensing. So this is the point that divides three images from five images, is when you go from out there to in here. And so so here's what he predicted it should look like based on this thing right here. And we looked at him and said, okay, that's nice, but it seems, what is the error bar on this prediction? And he said, well, it's got to be what it looks like. And that's just saying that if you try to fit some lens configuration to this, and the problem is that this map looks like it's super noisy. But all of this stuff out here is not noise, it's just the ringing from that coverage. So this is actually all signal that you're seeing. And so there's signal about this image configuration here way out in all of these points. And so when you plot it this way, it really you're misrepresenting the signal noise in the data. And so then we got the high resolution image of this, and you do the reconstruction. And this is the reconstruction. So based on this model, when we got the real data, the high resolution data, indeed, that's exactly what it looked like. So even though the data, it looked like we had no constraints on this, but it's just ALMA has extremely high signal noise. So now we're looking at 60 telescopes that are all 12 meters. And the SPT telescope that we discovered it with is a 10 meter dish, and there's one of them. So ALMA has extremely high signal noise. And so we shouldn't have been surprised, but it was still, it's one thing to believe in statistics, but every once in a while, it's amazing how well it works.
You also have to believe in your model, which is basically the model is that this is a smooth lens and lens of the source, and I guess it worked. So.
And it worked.
Yeah.
So this gives us confidence that we're not crazy. All right. So, so then you go forward and you say, well, we can skip this one. Let's just keep moving. So in principle, so this image I showed here is, this is all just a single color. It's just black and white because we're just treating all the flux as being equal. We're not differentiating between different wavelengths. But in principle, when you look at some complicated star forming region, there's going to be gas that's moving at all sorts of different velocities. And so if you could look at molecular lines, and so this image right down here is actually the stacked spectrum of something like 20 of our SPT sources, where you take 20 of them and just put them all on top of each other and shift them all so that they're all at their same redshift. And so you can't read any of these labels, but you see all these spikes. And all of these spikes are emission lines of various molecular forms. So there are CO lines, there are C+ lines. And it's just, molecular gas has lots of different ways that it can emit. And so if you have a bunch of molecular gas, you'll get lots of line emission. which means we could actually look for Doppler shifts in these lines shifting back and forth and break the source into different velocity bins. And that's what this is schematically meant to be. And what you would expect is that depending on the temperature of the gas, you would expect it to have different morphology. So different lines will trace different parts of the gas. And then when you then lens that, you'll get different appearances. So if you take this thing and you pass it through a lens, you get something that looks kind of like this. You take this and you pass it through a lens and you get a different morphology. You take this one, you pass it through a lens, something yet again. And what you can imagine is that in any one source, you're going to have a superposition of all of these things going on. So any one source will have this sort of smooth splotchiness and also this fine scale structure. And now imagine what happens if you stick a little dot down, which is a substructure. So you come up underneath one of these images with some little dot of substructure and you start distorting it. And so for this one, it would be hard to notice if you had a little dimple in it. For this stuff right here, you would just start splitting this stuff apart. And so there's some mismatch, there's some matching that's depending on exactly what the size, the characteristic lensing scale of your substructure is compared to the structure in your image. And so as of a couple of years ago, we actually didn't really have a good sense of what these high redshift star-forming galaxies would look like, that whether they would look like this or like this, or, you know, who knows? And it's just because the data didn't exist. These were redshift 2 star-forming galaxies. There wasn't a large population of them. ALMA had just turned on, so no one had really looked at them in detail. And all we had to go on was what nearby star-forming galaxies looked like. But nearby star-forming galaxies are not like these other things. It's a different animal, and so you had to make some guesses for what they looked like. So the way I like to think of this image right here, so is that, yeah, it's a bunch of colors all on top of each other, but I prefer to think of it as at every one of these wavelengths, at every wavelength, because the morphology is going to be different at every wavelength, instead of having just one lens, it's really a whole stack of lenses all at the same spot. Or it's a bunch of sources that all are getting fed through the same lens. And so you could treat these as individual probes. And yeah, it's true that in the source that there are some blobs of gas that do know something about each other. But all we care about is that these are photon bundles coming through. Like, I personally don't care about star formation. I have a claim that I throw out to anyone that ever says it, that I don't think there's even a definition of the star formation rate. I would like someone to define star formation for me. So I'll throw that out there. So maybe over lunch, someone can give me a consistent and well-defined definition of star formation. So how's that weighted over stars? And what do you do about deuterium fusion? And when does nuclear fusion start?
I'll just call it a star. I'll say star formation is defined as a moment when the region with no fusion.
Fusion of what?
You always have to
fusion. What would you mean?
I guess you have fusion in this room.
Yeah. There might be fusion in Jupiter, right? See? But where's the main sequence?
Well, there's a distinction between coming up with an observational and useful definition and coming up with a principle.
Yeah, and I think there's actually, it's impossible to come up with either one. That's my claim, is that. Yes. Lots of people agree that you can write a lot of papers on the star formation rate. That's true. So what's actually going on is very complicated and messy. And this is why we have Norm Murray working with us, is because he enjoys this stuff. And however, for the rest of us... See, Norm doesn't use the word star formation rate very much. Yes, Exactly right.
Okay, and you're saying that now that you know how those emission lines correspond to state, that would be the key input, I think, you need, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that's right. So it's that they're independent, and also that you see these little lumps in some of them. And so you have different scales and different bins, and that's what you can use as a way to really tell that you're not deluding yourself. That you can say, well, if it's lensing, it should be affecting this scale like this, and this scale like this, and this scale like this. So if you have a sufficiently messy object that has structure on all scales, then you can actually do a test of saying, is this messing around with the small scale things the way it's supposed to, but not messing around with the large scale things? So in fact, this method works best the more impossible to understand the star formation is. The messier the star formation is, the better. Because then you'll get this wide range in scales that you can work with. So you have this messy thing, and then let's say you put there's a lump right here of substructure. Well, that's going to mess around with this. So that's the cartoon version of what's going on. And then you just do lots of forward modeling, and you say, okay, well, let's take smooth models and put lumps down and see what happens. And that's, you know, what's going on here, where this cartoon, you stick this thing down, you put a lump down, and it moves stuff out. And now the question is quantifying with real data. First of all, can we detect it? And then once we have real data, we're now working on saying, where do we find any substructures? And that's where we are right now.
What kind of lump masses are you
Let's see. So, you know, there's always some continuum. So it depends on exactly where the lump is, right? So first of all, you're only going to see a lump if it's near one of these images. So if you put a lump over there somewhere, you're never going to detect it. And so there's increased sensitivity where it is compared to different things. And so where the lensing is changing fastest is where you're most sensitive to a lump. So if you put a lump down in just the right spot, we can get below 10 to the 7 solar masses. In general, we're pretty sensitive to stuff around 10 to the 8 is kind of the sweet spot. That's where there's lots of them. Where there's enough of them where you'd expect to be able to see them in an image, you know, there's enough things that are around 10 to the 8 that you should expect one to fall somewhere near one of these caustics or one of these images.
But below 10 to the 7, you don't see them, essentially.
Yeah, below 10 to the 7, it would have to be extremely favorable. It's not impossible. It's just we'd have to get one to land in just the right spot. Now, on the other hand, there should be a lot more at 10 to the 7 than there are at 10 to the 8. So, you know, there's a trade-off there that we're still trying to figure out.
But I guess one thing would then they all blend together at some point, and I don't know where that is.
Well, so that's we have ideas for that too. So I'll get to that in a sec. Okay. So the first thing we do is we say, can we detect these things? And so we did an analysis of exactly how sensitive we are using realistic ALMA observations. So basically, ALMA, when you propose for it, there's this tool you can use. You say, I want to observe for this long on this source with these conditions, and it gives you everything you need to know about the noise, and you can do simulated observations. So we did simulated observations. We said, we don't really know anything about the source. We're just going to put in basically some combination of 60 blobby things and sizes. Say we don't know where they are, we don't know how big they are, we're just going to say there's 60 of them and just run it through a joint fit and marginalize over all the source parameters. And so I guess it was 20 blobs that had a position and a flux or size, something like that. And what we find is in the end, that if we don't include the information about different colors, so if we don't use the velocity information, then if you put a lump down that's 10 to the 8 solar masses, and you can sort of detect it at something like 3 sigma. So that's, you know, this is plus or minus 0.3 or something in mass. You put in this color information, and you see that now we get a much tighter detection. So using this multi-frequency information for some assumptions about the morphology, let you get a very clean detection of something that's 10 to the 8 solar masses. This is why I say 10 to the 8, that's kind of that's where it's easy for us, is 10 to the 8.
So what's the angular scale that you seem to get around on by the pumps?
So The typical scale that we care about are scales that work out to be about 100 parsecs. So I used to know this the other way. So it's kind of 0.01 arc seconds, I think, is something like that. So it's below 0.1 arc seconds, but not way below it. So it's certainly at 0.01, it's no problem. Oh, you mean the source parameters?
Yeah.
These are the
60 times.
No, this is putting in at any time saying the source is some superposition. So it's 60 source parameters, and I think the parameters would be, there's probably 4 parameters per source. So I think we just said we're going to assume there are 15 sources within that field of view. So the source itself is some superposition of 15 objects. And we have no way of telling the difference between them. Because what we didn't want to do is just put in a single blob, because a single blob is a very unrealistic view. And we figured that 15 is at that level where, if you just allow them to find their own where they want to be.
Is this 15 plus 1 versus 15, or is it 15?
This one was just 15. So what we're doing now is we just do a pixelated reconstruction where we just let the source be whatever it wants.
So you would get 15 separate
observations? No. No, we're so let's see. So the idea is that there's some source, and what we're assuming is that the source is looking like this. And then we take some and then we take this source and then we feed it through, we lens it. And then we try to do a reconstruction. We try to guess. We're looking for a lump in the lens.
So 10th base is the sum of the masses of all of these
lumps. Oh, okay, sorry.
So there's one source that's made up of 15 objects.
Source is a big lumpy mess.
Yeah.
Your lens is one smooth thing plus a single lump.
Yeah, lens is smooth plus one lump. And then what we're doing is we're using, so in this case, we're marginalizing over this 15 lump source and all of the parameters that you would need. So you need 60 parameters to parameterize your 60 lump source. So we marginalize over these 60 parameters to find how well we can get the lump. And the idea of that is we're just trying to make sure that we're not fooling ourselves by getting confused by something in the source. Yeah. So what's going to happen is, so in this multicolor thing, basically each one of these colors is a different one of these lumps, basically, right? So what's going to happen is you put so all of these things are having some sensitivity, but some of them, you can see that there's some colors here, like this red one right here is not really going to be very sensitive to a lump that's right here just because it's not very close to it. So some stuff doesn't get lensed into a spot. The sources, if you draw the caustics, so in the source plane, if you put the caustics over this, you'll generally get caustics that'll look something like this. And so what'll happen is that you'll have, so some of your lumps are over here, and those will form some images over in one spot. But then these ones are a totally different, these are all completely different lensing configurations. And there's only a couple of these that are going to be giving you sources that are mapping into that spot that's close to a lump. But you don't know where that's going to be a priori. And so for the most part, most of these sources, like this source right here, is just going to go right onto the Einstein ring or something like that. But so different ones of these, different lumps will turn out to be more sensitive, but going in, you don't know. Oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe I should use lumps and clumps. So clumps, so some clumps, there will only be a few clumps that turn out to be carrying most of the lump information.
So
that's not my spectrum.
I guess the most cosmologically useful thing would be a sort of lump power spectrum, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah, no, so I'm about to show exactly that. So here's what we get. We get, so you feed it through.
Can I back up just one moment?
Okay.
And ask you about just normal scattering. So that will produce a wavelength-dependent substructure in the image.
Electron scattering.
Yeah, right. So just plasma scattering.
Okay.
So we see this towards the galactic center. In many other cases,
yeah. So you're saying if we have a lump of electrons somewhere?
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. Yeah, we can find those two.
You can find those two. But
that's fine.
Can you separate those?
You know what? I look forward to having that problem. Like,
yes.
That'd be. So how could you separate them?
The frequency dependence would be.
Well, that's the thing. Is that there's a frequency dependence from the electron scattering, which comes from the plasma, right?
Yeah. So you
also frequency dependence in the lensing signature because of the frequency dependence of structure in the source.
Yeah.
And so now you have two different frequency dependencies that in principle, if you had an unstructured source, you could separate.
Yeah.
But if with a structured source, I imagine that the structure in your screen and the structure in your source are degenerate somehow.
Yeah. So so at this point we've liked the fact that all of our that these things separate nicely, that you have image noise, you have source noise, and you have lens noise. But the frequency dependence of the, effectively you could think of, it's the exact same thing that all lensing is, you can think of it as an index of refraction, right? That you have this image and you just have an index of refraction, except that in that case, it's achromatic. But you're saying that we're now gonna add a chromatic lens. And how could we separate that out? So
just do this in different frequencies, even though you get the same lump mass.
So it wouldn't look like lensing, right? It wouldn't look like gravitational lensing. It would look like something else, and it would ruin your lensing. Yeah.
I assume at some point you, right now you have a bunch of blobs, but one thing you could do is you could just say that my source is constructed components that have some sort of correlation length that depends on.
So what we do right now is we just let the source be a bunch of pixels subject to the constraint that it has a power spectrum that is what you would expect from one of these objects. So it's basically, we assume it's something like a Gaussian random field with some some power spectrum, which is what you're saying. Yeah. Right. Yeah, I.
Something like that.
I think you could fit to it, right? I mean, but it's going
to
make it messier. Yeah. So I think it's easy to write down what to do, and there's a question. It's clear what could be calculated, but I don't know the answer.
I guess the easier thing is just estimate that there's a big effect from that.
Well, so that's the other thing is that this Einstein ring. What's nice about lensing is you get these Einstein rings, which means you're not going right through the center, so it might not be so bad.
Well, so clearly the large scale is due to gravity.
Yeah.
Small scale modifications.
Yeah.
Those are
Sure.
Much smaller scale.
Sure, but it's not going right through any galaxy.
Yeah, right.
So, you know, it's probably not that bad, but, you know, we should, you know, there's no reason not to calculate it. It's clear, it's straightforward to calculate, so we should do it.
The idea is, like, based on the number of the lumps for each halo that you can observe, and you can make a model for the satellites, and
yeah,
come up with it, because you want, so it still will be, it's as if you're observing one satellite per galaxy.
Yeah, and it turns out that's roughly where we are, that with cycle 2 ALMA, so now that we're moving on to cycle 3, we haven't got our cycle 2 data yet. What we were finding is that we should be finding something somewhere between 1 and 4 of order 10 to the 8 halos per galaxy. And that depended on the source morphology. So it depended on whether those things were 200 parsecs or 150 parsecs. Is what we were going for, and that just depends on what the characteristic sizes were. So we just had to guess at the time because we didn't know.
Why is that flattening out?
Oh, because it's cumulative, and it just means that at low, it's cumulative above that. It just says that we haven't, in these ones, we had no sensitivity to 10 to the 7 for where we put them. But, you know, this was just trying to figure out where they would be. So when we do the simulations, we should see stuff. We should be able to measure the mass someday as soon as we get the data. And so we have our cycle 2 program in, and we should be finding them as soon as we get our data. So we're waiting for our data. So if you know anyone at ALMA, please tell them to give us our data.
Are they holding on?
No, they actually haven't taken, they're not, the data hasn't been taken yet, so I guess they're not holding on to it, but it feels like they are. But as people have pointed out, there's more information than just a single lump. You could really think of it as there's some screen, you know, that in reality you have this complicated mess like this. That the substructure has some range in scales, there's a bunch of different lumps, and once you get down to low masses, they're going to start to overlap, and you won't be able to talk about individual lumps. And so the question is, what do you do if this is your substructure field? And so what we did is we said, well, if this was just some power spectrum of fluctuations, would we be able to measure that? And so now it's the same thing, except you just stick in a random screen of fluctuations. You characterize it by its some amplitude and slope in some power spectrum, and you say, can we measure that? And so Yasher, we all did that, and we found that yes, in fact, soon we will be able to measure that power spectrum. So here's what we should be able to do. So. If you parameterize the power spectrum, you basically, it's not great. It means in two bins with a 40-hour integration, you could get a few sigma constraints. So it's not going to be easy, because 40 hours is a lot. I know it doesn't seem like much to us, but there's a lot of people trying to get ALMA time. So it'll probably be a few years before anyone's going to let us just stare at a source for 40 hours. But
according to
only once you define star formation. Star formation can be anything until it's defined.
Maybe this is a star formation.
So we will get this dark matter substructure power spectrum, in a few years with ALMA.
10 kiloparsec or a kiloparsec to 10
kiloparsec.
So and that's kind of the scale of those images, right? That's the scale of the images we were looking at. So non-Gaussian doesn't matter. Now, while we're waiting for our data, and so I'll finish up here, don't worry, I'm almost done. So while we're waiting for them to give us our cycle 2 data, they conveniently put out their new data, which is much better than the data we proposed for in cycle 2, on this object SDP81. And this is a science verification data of the new super-duper ALMA configuration, which has 10-kilometer baselines, or more than 10-kilometer baselines. Whereas the previous stuff, the data we're waiting for, has more like 1.5-kilometer baselines. So it's super high resolution, and it's similar sensitivity to what we could get. So the main gain is that it's much higher resolution. And so here are the images that come out from this. And you may have noticed all sorts of stories. So a raft of papers have come out talking about high-resolution ALMA observations. And there have been, at least in Google News, it seemed like about once a week there would be a new news story about someone else that took this data and analyzed it and made a nice picture of it and then did some lensing reconstruction of it. So it's very nice data, and it's super high resolution lens image.
Are you doing it as well?
Yeah, so we're working on it as well just to see if we can. So this is what we're currently using to look for lumps. While we're waiting for data on our objects, we're looking for lumps here. So this is a more massive lens than most of ours. This is kind of almost a group scale lens, but it's okay. So we now do pixelated lens modeling, which is to say we allow some just a source to be just some raster of pixels. So we just allow them to be independent any way we want. We lens them, pass them through the visibilityometer, and so just do forward modeling of the whole thing. And then we just allow the source to be whatever we want, subject, and then we put a penalty in that it needs to have the power spectrum that we expect it to have. So there's independent codes. And here's what we get, is we get something that looks kind of like this. This is our reconstruction of the source.
Can you measure the power spectrum?
So we could measure the power spectrum, but since we put that in as a prior, it's probably going to have the power spectrum reasonably close to what we put in at some level. It doesn't need to, but...
I mean, where do you get the power spectrum from? You have to measure it from...
So we're using a power spectrum prior that Norm tells us is what it should be. So Norm Murray says this is what a star-forming galaxy should look like. And we say, okay, it should look like a star-forming galaxy in broad brush. And then we do the reconstruction, and it looks like this. And so we haven't gotten very far in actually delving into the source. And so it's a couple clumps, and then here's the lensing caustics. And what you see is that, you know, it's a couple different lenses all rolled together. And what you see here is what 100 parsecs is. And what you see is that that does seem to be about the scale, is 100 parsecs. So when I said we'd find a few objects, that was if the source was 150 parsecs or 250 parsecs.
Sorry, these are the lumps?
These are the clumps.
So they're the source, not
yeah,
the lumps.
These are the clumps. So the clumps are about 100 parsecs. So this is a reconstruction of the clumps. So this is reverse engineering that lensing operation to see what it looks like. And this is what we did in the using visibility modeling. And so using image-based stuff, so one of those 10 papers that came out doing this is their version of the same plot. And so this is working in the image space, in the image plane. So it's a different way of doing it. And you know, but what you find is that broadly speaking, there's this idea that it's clearly just a straight up and down thing with two clumps and a little bit of wispiness to it. This is the first time that we can really start saying, here is what these things look like. So up until now, we didn't really have a population of known high redshift, massively star-forming galaxies that we could look at to say what do they look like, and now we do. So we're working on it, trying to find. Well, that's weird. I had one more plot in here. I don't know what happened to it. Oh, good. So we do it channel by channel, and we're looking for dark matter. So. Here's where we are. So this plot right here is the number of subhalos as a function of mass. And in the background here are lines of how many of what we should be finding in this space, depending on exactly what the lens mass. And so the lens mass, we have an Einstein radius for it. So we know exactly what the mass is within some radius. But the problem is that if this is a dark matter halo, this would be the virial radius. The Einstein radius is just barely outside the stellar region. So we really just have some constraint on what the mass is within this radius. We have Spitzer imaging and HST imaging on this object, so we know what the stellar mass is, but we don't know what the total mass of the halo is. And it turns out that when you're looking for dark matter substructure, a key component of the whole thing is what the total mass of your dark matter halo is, because a more massive dark matter halo has more lumps in it. And it's almost linear in the mass, that if you have a 10 times bigger dark matter halo, you'll have 10 times the amount of substructure.
But is
So all of the substructure that we're sensitive to is the stuff that's close to the Einstein radius.
But is it close in projection or close in?
Close in projection.
Okay, so it could be anywhere.
It could be anywhere. And so there's all these mysteries of, for one, what is the radial profile of substructure in real halos, if there is any substructure? So A, is there substructure? B, how is it distributed as a function of radius? But at the same time, we need to know exactly how massive the halo is before we can make any real predictions. And so despite the fact that we know so much about this galaxy, we only know the mass of the halo to something like to within a factor of 10. I don't know, 0.8, I think, somewhere around there. Yeah, you would think that. Not much better, because the problem is it's a very massive galaxy, and the stellar mass, so we have a good estimate of the stellar mass, and usually people go from stellar mass to halo mass with not too much uncertainty, but once you get above a certain stellar mass, the whole thing falls apart. I don't know. I can look. Yeah, but
it,
yeah. Oh, yeah, it's not 10 to the, yeah. It's almost certainly not 10 to the 14, because that would be a galaxy cluster. And but, you know, certainly in this range, it could be in there anywhere.
But then, I mean, I think it doesn't have to be in the halo. The sub-halo.
That's true. It could be along the line of sight as well.
So then you cannot actually measure this because...
Most of them are in...
Yeah. But, you know, these are all problems that I look forward to having.
Yes.
Right? Okay. That, so we're getting there. So there's a summary. So there are now large samples of these strongly lensed galaxies. So SBT has them. ACT has a few. Planck thinks they found a couple. Herschel's got a bunch. And they're perfect for this. It seems like the clump size is well matched for exactly these studies. ALMA is perfect for this because you have both the high angular resolution and high spectral resolution, which lets you do all sorts of neat things. And it should be detectable with current ALMA stuff. So I expect that within probably a year, you'll find people detecting lumps within on the time scale of a year. So you guys have to figure out what to do with them. Or we won't find them, and that'll be interesting too. All right.
Lumps, does that mean you think within a year they can detect lumps in size?
10 to the 8. Yeah.
So if you sort of go back to thinking about your power spectrum, you know, you have some power spectrum in substructure and halo, and there's some arbitrary normalization from all your predictions.
Yep. Yeah.
So obviously it's interesting once it's statistical.
Yeah. So I think where we are is that at least in terms of the lumps, it'll probably be finding them in the ones and twos in individual objects. And and that's limited by just how much ALMA time we'll get.
That, so
we could probably find of order 100. Now what's weird about it is that it's spread in mass and redshift. And so the main problem with the uncertainties about the source structure is that you don't know whether a given source is going to be good for this until you look. That if a source turns out to be a big, fuzzy, single, monolithic blob, then it's going to be really bad for this because the substructure will perturb it, but it'll all it's going to do is move some little bit of flux to somewhere where there's already some flux. And in the end, you won't see a difference. So if it's a big blob, if the source is large compared to these the size of these perturbers, then that source will be really bad for this. And so you'll know it once you get it. And so it's hard to say ahead of time whether something's going to be good, but once you look, you'll just go, oh yeah, it's perfect. So from the sources, I don't think it's a problem. I'd say that the sources, what we find is that as many parameters as we add to our source model, because you start with a single blob and you say, well, let's just see if it works on a single blob, and then you add another blob, and then you add another blob, and then we said, you know what, surely blobs are not the way to go. Let's just use some arbitrary distribution. And what we find is that as long as you put some, so if you put no prior at all on what the source looks like, then the best fit is always going to be a completely unlensed source that just happens to look like your image, right? I mean, that's always going to be the best fit to the data, because you can't do any better than that. You could say, well, if I'm allowed any source morphology whatsoever, I'm just going to have something that looks like a ring. So you have to always have some prior on what a reasonable source is. And as long as you have something like, it has to have roughly the right correlation structure, we've never seen a case where when we introduce a new parameter for the source, the substructure constraints go away.
So you're biased against ring dogs.
Ring sources, yeah. So unlensed ring sources are, well, for the most part. I mean, there are a couple cases where we look at the SP, we get the ALMA data for an SPT source and no lens model can fit it. That has happened. Where you look at it and it just turns out that just because there's a couple blobs next to each other doesn't mean it's a lens. When you actually try to fit it as a lens, it just doesn't have the right shape to be a lens. And that's just saying that not everything is lensed, which, that's fine. So there's a little bit of jitter.
If you get 100 of these and they're all cute and they all have their individual stuff going on.
Yeah.
I guess my question is just, is that 100, with the sensitivity that's plus or minus a factor of 3, or 100 with the sensitivity that's plus or minus a factor of 10? In other words, if you're trying to understand what that 100 means.
Well, I'm telling, what I'm more worried about is this plot. Which is to, so we have a bunch of these plots. So this is versus the host mass, but there's also how the substructure is distributed within a halo. There's also exactly what the mass function is of the substructure, and all these things matter. And so the thing is, we have a heterogeneous sample. So yeah, it's 100, that's great, but it's 100 snowflakes. Each one has its own mass that we don't know very well. So at lower masses, we'll know these masses better, so that's true. So we don't know the masses perfectly, and so you're trying to compare all of these things that are all different masses, all different redshifts, and we need to organize these things according to some, we have to somehow organize these things into bins and then try to come up with some consistent story for what it's telling us about substructure across the whole population. And I can imagine, and the problem, that's always going to have these problems, that it's always going to have these astrophysical uncertainties built in about exactly what is the object that you're looking at? Because all we have is the stellar mass of some lens. And so given the stellar mass of some lens, we can say that things that look like this in stars tend to have these substructure properties. We can do that. But it's going to take a while to actually go all the way forward.
I think the first order is a kind of binary, that what you want to see is there substructure?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And there's some substructure from just the barotons.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I think that's exactly it. Is that, there's a procedure, which is how much substructure is there and then how is it distributed? So there's sort of a path forward for how it all goes, but it starts by first we need to collect these things, which starts with us getting our data.
something like that. The longer you get now, the better you get hundreds of days of CDM, right? Or not just a couple.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's exactly this argument, that we have about 100 of them. And so we're either going to get 100 or we're going to get none. And so we'll see what happens.
Well, in view of time, if there's no urgent question, let's thank Bill.